This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Welcome to this episode of Fairways and Greens. I'm your host, Gaylord Rhodes, the Vegas golf coach. And after 30 years as a golf professional, teacher, and coach, I decided it was time to share the knowledge and insights into the world of golf that I have gathered during my career as a golf professional. And joining me each episode will be a special guest from the golf industry. Together, we will discuss and share their insights, expertise, knowledge, and stories from their career and life in golf as well. Hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, I welcome and appreciate your input and suggestions for future shows, as well as your questions. So feel free to reach out and get in touch with me, the Vegas Golf Coach, by emailing me at info@golfcoachpodcast.com. That's info@golfcoachpodcast.com. Reach out and let us know what's on your mind and what you're thinking about. So let's get started with today's show. I want to welcome everyone into this week's episode of Fairways and Greens. This is a special week for the show. It's Masters Week, and I am excited to have a special guest in, the actual grandson of the great Bobby Jones, the founder of Augusta National, one of the greatest amateurs of all time. And I have Dr. Bob Jones IV in as my guest. Dr. Bob, how are you this morning?
I'm doing very well, Gaylord. How are you? It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you. So it's Masters Week, and you were such a young, at a young age when you got to know your grandfather, and can you kind of share a little bit about your relationship with him?
Well, you know, it's funny, I was 14 years old when he passed away in December of 71. So I knew him basically throughout the latter stage of his illness. And many of the experiences that I had with him would not be your typical grandfather-grandson experiences. For example, there weren't going to be many times when we would go fishing together or hit the golf course together because my grandfather was in the throes of a crippling illness. But what I do remember of him is a man that, at least to me, was extraordinarily kind, very patient, probably one of the most wonderful people to be around that I've ever encountered. And certainly it's one of the great highlights of my life and great memory as well.
So when you first got, I know that there was a rule at Augusta back in those days that you really couldn't attend until you were 12 years old. And I would like to let the audience know what, and let's talk about the tournament a little bit to start out with. And
sure.
I know you're going in this week, and I know the interesting part about it was is that you're actually not a member at Augusta National, but
no.
your father was, and it was actually the vice president of the club. Is that correct?
That's correct. My great-grandfather, Bobby Jones's father, actually had membership certificate number one. That's what we called my grandfather was Bub.
Right.
Had membership certificate number two. Then my father, he joined sometime in the 1960s. It took a long time for him to become a member as well, but he finally became a member in the 1960s. And at the time of his death in 1973, he was vice president of the club. That's right. So after his death, we kind of passed off the scene at Augusta National. And then a number of years later, mainly through the work of my grandfather's law partner, Buster Byrd, who was also a member of the National, we started attending the Masters again. And the club has been very kind to provide us with credentials every year, and they've been very, very helpful in that regard. So it's still a cordial relationship.
Well, that's good. That's good to know. I know there was a little bit of falling out there toward the last 10 years or so of your grandfather's life with he and Cliff Roberts kind of had a little bit
they
of
did.
Yeah.
It was more than a little bit of a falling out. They had a very serious falling out. And I suspect to disagree. It came from a couple of different things. On the one hand, I think that, you know, as Cliff's friendship with President Eisenhower, as after Eisenhower left the White House and then later became very ill and ultimately passed away himself, I think that, you know, that Cliff tried to recapture some of that sense of power that he had through his friendships with, you know, people like Ike, through his control over Augusta National. And at the same time, my grandfather's health was deteriorating, and I think my grandfather had a little bit of difficulty with that as well. And I think when you put those two together in two very, very strong men, I think given that mix, I think a conflict was inevitable, to be honest.
Well, I'm kind of interested in knowing how they got together. I know Cliff Roberts was a big Wall Street banker, and you know, when your grandfather had the vision of building Augusta National, how did those two get together? How'd that all come about? Do you?
Well, they met actually in Augusta, and they were brought together by some mutual friends who knew that Bub had an interest in acquiring the Berkman's plantation, but he also needed somebody that could help raise the money for a membership. Bub was able to contact pretty much anybody he needed to in the Southeast, but in order to make Augusta what Bub wanted it to be, which was a national golf club, he needed somebody who could find some access into the financiers and the business people that existed in New York and the Northeast. Cliff at the time, just like Bub, was fairly young and was in the process of making his career, and yet he did have some really good connections in that community, and so it was just an absolutely perfect opportunity. And again, they were both young, bright, strong personalities, and they absolutely were a perfect combination. You know, it's very, very strange. It's very easy to want to paint the Bub-Cliff relationship in very two-dimensional terms, to say that, you know, Bub was a good guy and Cliff was not, or Bub was this, or Cliff was this and Bub was not. But the fact of the matter is, in order to make Augusta National what it is and the Masters what it is today, you needed both Bob Jones and Cliff Roberts. One without the other, and you would have had a totally different kind of experience than the Masters is today.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I mean, what a perfect combination to get this and to see where it's gone today. And I think you see a lot more of Cliff's Roberts and more of his influence in the tournament today. It's become a huge business. It's you know, I've heard it described as the Super Bowl of golf, and you could probably put the world. I mean, you could mix all the great sporting events together into the Masters. It's gotten to be such a huge, huge deal for us golf professionals, and I'm speaking for myself. It always represented the start of this golf season, and then of course the TPC came in, and the Players Championship was in March for a while, and that kind of kicked off the season. But it was still the Masters that kind of started everything for us, that first major, and it was. So back in when the golf course, I believe it opened in 1934.
33.
So the first tournament was 1934?
Uh-huh. That's correct. Won by Horton Smith.
And it was the known as the Invitational back then. And it took a while.
Well, they renamed it the Masters in 1935. And Bub did not like it. Bub thought calling that golf tournament the Masters was unbelievably pretentious. Just did not like it. But finally, after Arnold Palmer won his second Masters in 1960, and Bub saw all the attention that was given to the tournament in that year, Bub said, well, I may have thought that it once was born of a touch of immodesty, but he said, probably Masters is the right name for it now. So he ultimately came to embrace it and to recognize the place that the Masters had assumed in the world of golf, or was assuming at the time.
Well, I know a lot about, you know, your grandfather's story. Being a golf professional, I've read several of his books. I he started out at a young age, had a wildly crazy temper, and so I know I want to let my audience know that Dr. Bob is a sports psychologist, and just to give us some insight into your grandfather and how he went from this impetuous temper tantrum kid to winning 13 majors. And I know he kind of came into his own in 1923, and he had that run from 23 to 1930 when he won the Grand Slam. And kind of give us a little bit of background into what you know about that period in his life. And just, I'd love to hear that story.
Well, you know, I think it came about somewhat accidentally. I mean, his temper, I think to a certain extent, his temper was the result of having grown up in a very, very restricted environment. He was born on St. Patrick's Day of 1902, and he was born with stomach and gastric problems that were so severe that he couldn't even eat solid food until he was 5 years old. And on top of all that, there were so many times when his health was very precarious that he was not able to get out and play in a manner that you would expect of a child, of an ordinary child. And so a lot of his time was spent inside his home reading books. And to be candid, I think that over time, like anybody would, he started chafing at that and being very angry about that. And when he started playing golf, that anger kind of carried over onto the golf course. That and the fact that he was incredibly perfectionistic, just could not tolerate anything that was not just so. So when he started playing tournaments, if a round wasn't going as he thought it would, he would just lose his temper, throw clubs, curse, the whole nine yards. And he did that because he believed that ultimately it only hurt himself. And so therefore, somehow that made it okay. And everything went along fine in a way until about 1921 or 22, when he was playing in a USGA event and he hit a bad shot, or a shot that he thought was bad, and he let out a curse and he threw his club and it bounced off the ground and it hit a spectator in the gallery, a lady in the gallery, hit her in the shin and broke her shin open. And there she was bleeding. And that was the first time it had ever occurred to Bub that his actions could hurt somebody other than himself. When he returned back to Atlanta, shortly after he returned, he got a letter from George Herbert Walker, who was at that time the president of the United States Golf Association. He was also, by the way, the maternal grandfather of George H.W. Bush. And the letter from the USGA said that unless and until my grandfather could learn to control his temper, that his applications for United States Golf Association events would not be accepted. And that had such a profound impact on him. And that, combined with that realization that was growing that his actions actually were even hurting him, made him decide at that point that nobody would ever know from looking at him how he was doing, either over or under par. And from that moment on, he harnessed his temper in golf tournaments. Now, he always said to the end of his life that when he was playing a round of golf and he didn't have to be on his company manners, that there were some emotions that could not be borne with a golf club in your hands. But in tournament golf, he did not want people to ever be able to see where he stood to par based on his external reactions. And I think that harnessing of that ability and some of the things that he learned, like controlling his breathing, watching the pace at which he walked, monitoring the small muscles of his face, which I can explain that to you in a bit if you need me to.
Yes, yes.
When you take those things into account, it allowed him to develop a sense of focus that gave him the ability to go on a run of golf that we have seen maybe, we may not have seen a run like that that he had from 23 to 30 until you get to the era of Tiger Woods.
I agree.
Tiger may be the only other person to have thoroughly dominated the game of golf for a certain period of time, quite like Bub did. And that's kind of how he did it.
Yeah.
That's how he did it.
And I think his, you know, being an amateur, I think Tiger's amateur record and your grandfather's amateur record were two of the most outstanding things in the world. I mean, to win all the junior amateurs and the you know, U.S. amateurs as an amateur, and the fact that your grandfather was an amateur all the way through his career was something that'll never happen again. And it's just the game's so evolved now. And I grew up and I got the Hollywood films, you know, Bobby Jones, How I Play Golf, and I just amazed at your grandfather's golf swing, and it was one of the things that inspired me to go play golf. And you know, there was a period though when he was a little bit younger, and I've had a guest on, Dan Gleason, earlier, and who did a interview with Alexis Sterling's heirs, and it was a fascinating story about how she and Bobby grew up and were played in a 6-hole tournament when they were kids at East Lake. And she went on to become one of the most famous women amateur golfers of that era. And they went out and did, during the war, they went out and did exhibitions together. Can you kind of give our audience a little bit about that? Because Dan really, her heirs really didn't have that story. And I'd love to share that with my audience.
The story of the Red Cross matches?
That's correct.
Yes, it was during World War I. Bub mm-hmm. would have been probably, 15, 16 years old.
Correct, yeah.
Before I get into that, I also want to tell you about Alexa. You know, people forget about Alexa Sterling, I guess, and that's
amazing.
Really unfortunate.
Yeah.
But when Alexa played, back when she played, the women's amateur was like the world championship of golf. And Alexa won that three times. She won it in 1916, 1919, and 1920. And the only reason she did not win it five times is because the amateur wasn't even played in 1917 and 18 because of World War I.
Correct.
So she could have potentially been, won that thing five times in a row. She was an extraordinarily dominant player. And so when World War I came up, the American Red Cross decided to get the Georgia Dixie Whiz kids, which were Perry Adair, who from up until 1916 was considered the dominant golfer in Georgia.
Right.
Perry Adair, my grandfather, Elaine Rosenthal, and Alexa Sterling. And they went out to raise money all across the United States, mostly in the Northeast and the Southeast, playing these exhibitions. They would get out on the golf course, and they all had these like red berets that they wore on while they were playing for the Red Cross. And during the time when they played in 1918, they raised, well, in what would be in today's dollars, something like $5.7 million playing golf exhibitions. When, bear in mind, I mean, Alexa was probably in 1918, I think she was 21, and Perry would have been about 19 or 20, and Bub was all of 15 or 16. I do not know how old Elaine Rosenthal was at the time, but I mean, these were very, very young people. And, you know, they raised a ton of money for the war effort.
Yeah, it was.
And so that's how that went on.
Yeah, it was such an interesting story. I'm curious. Did Bobby still have his temper issues back then when he was?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh yes, very definitely.
Yeah.
He very definitely did, because remember, in 1919, that was when he, 1921, excuse me, when he played in his first British Open at St. Andrews. That was the one where he withdrew from the tournament on the 11th hole of the third round.
That's correct.
And literally just tore up his scorecard. I mean, he kept playing. The myth is that he walked off the golf course, but he did not.
Interesting.
He actually continued to play. And one of the things that he learned was, had he continued to play, even with the hideous score that he had on that 11th hole, he still would have finished like third or fourth.
Gotcha.
And the lesson that he learned from that was that that in golf, you never know how things are going to work out. But Alexa and he remained very, very close friends until the day of my grandfather's death.
Well, I'd like to, if you have any insight in this, I know O.B. Keeler played he was the big sports writer in the Atlanta Journal, and I know he kind of chronicled your grandfather's life in many ways, but I know he had, at some point, O.B. had some kind of a talk with him, or told him, if you'd ever get your temper under control, or is that true, or what? Just some insight in the relationship. Yeah.
Yes and no. I'll tell you how that worked. O.B. accompanied Bub pretty much everywhere, because remember, Bub was very young.
Right.
And he needed a chaperone. A person of that age just couldn't travel around the country alone. And so O.B. went. And after watching Bub play for many, 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 many rounds of golf, finally in 1923, they were getting ready to go to the playoff against Bobby Cruikshank at Inwood in Long Island for the United States Open.
Right.
Bub said he'd finished like a yellow dog and deserved to lose. And because Cruikshank, he played horribly on the home stretch, and Cruikshank played very well to catch him. But Bub always felt that he shouldn't have ever allowed somebody to be in a position to catch him. At any rate, as they were getting ready to go to the playoff the next day on that Sunday morning, OB took Bub aside. Bub was saying something that just didn't really sit well with OB, and OB stopped him, took him by the shoulder, and said, "Son, you are the greatest golfer in the world. And when you get that through your head, you're not just going to win one championship, you're going to win them all." And that's all he said.
Wow.
And in some ways, OB in some ways functioned like not just a reporter, but he controlled Bub's press pool. And in many ways, he was Bub's sports psychologist. Because, I mean, if you stop and think about that, to a large extent, a lot of the times with sports psychology, while we do all sorts of different things with people, I mean, work on them on all sorts of different techniques, sometimes the best thing that we can do for people is to be able to allow them to see themselves from our eyes instead of their own.
Exactly.
And that is something that O.B. Keeler was able to do that nobody else really could do. Not Stuart Maiden, not Alexa Sterling, although she came close, but not Alexa Sterling, and certainly not even Grantland Rice, the great sports writer.
Right.
Although Grantland Rice was a very dear friend of Bub's, nobody could quite get to him in the same way that Pop Keeler could.
Well, there's also the story of the day of the, I think maybe the day before the morning of the playoff with Bobby, that Bobby's grandfather sent him a Western Union wire. And let our audience know about that, because I think that was significant as well. I think that, and then all of a sudden, from that point on, he won 13 majors. It was great story.
It's very, very funny. There are a lot of things that have been written about my grandfather over the years, and if you read much of his the writing about him, you come away with certainly an awareness of the closeness that existed between Bub and his father, my great-grandfather. But, and that's true, they certainly were close. But there were two people who were extraordinarily formative in Bub's life. One of them was his grandfather, the original Robert Tyer Jones.
Correct.
And the other was his mother. Granny gets very, very little press in terms of the influence that she had on the development of her son. So as far as my great-great-grandfather, Robert Tyer Jones, he was extraordinarily formative in Bub's life. They were very, very close, even though he lived in Canton, which was about, 45 miles north of Atlanta back in the day when that was an all-day journey.
Right.
He was a very, very stern man, a huge man. He was probably 6'3", weighed over 200 pounds, and he basically owned Canton, Georgia, and ran a mill and a bank and a general store. He was an extremely devout Christian, was the superintendent of the Baptist Sunday School up there for 33 years. And Bub looked to him for a lot of stability and guidance. He also knew that his grandfather really didn't approve of, frivolous activities like sporting events. And so he was very surprised when that morning of that playoff came against Cruikshank to see a telegram from Robert Tyer Jones Jr. that said two things. It said, hit all the fairways and make all the putts go down. And then it said, if you have to play golf on the Lord's Day, play well. Love, Grandfather.
Wow, I hadn't heard that last part.
Yep,
I hadn't heard that last part. So is,
and it's very funny. I mean, Mr. RT, as I said, he could be a real crusty sort of guy. In fact, one of the stories that's told about him when he was up and living in Canton was he was sleeping on the porch of his home late one night when this man came in the house and attempted to rob Mr. RT's house. And in the middle of the night, in the pitch black darkness, Mr. RT hollered out, "You stop right there." And the guy stopped while Mr. RT sent one of the family to get the sheriff. And when the sheriff came, he said to the guy, he said, "I don't get it." He said, "It's pitch black dark. There's no light on in here. It's the days before electricity." He said, "You could have just run away. Why did you just stay here and wait for me?" And the guy looked over at the sheriff. He said, "Did you ever have Mr. RT tell you to stay right there?" He said, "When Mr. RT tells you to stay right there, you stay right there. You don't move." And just by the command of his personality, that's how strong Robert Tyer Jones was. So, and his impact on his family was every bit as strong as that. So when he sent that telegram to Bub, that combined with what OB had told him was nothing short of a 1-2 punch. Nothing short of a 1-2 punch.
No, I can imagine. The interesting thing is the time that when Bobby, of course, we're talking from 1923 to 1930. You've got the Roaring Twenties, and he became like the Babe. I mean, he was Bobby, and he just captivated the world in many ways. And I mean, as I understand it, until John Glenn had his second ticker tape parade, your grandfather was the first and only man to have two ticker tape parades.
Well, that is correct. And that's absolutely correct. And honestly, I think for his time, I think the thing that was so amazing is I think he was probably even bigger than Babe Ruth.
I agree.
He wrote a column for, I believe, King Features Syndicate that was published in 650 newspapers around the country. Back then, you could write a column, and it would not affect your amateur status. Now that's not true, but back then it was.
Really?
And it was read by, in 650 newspapers. I think in the early part of the winning years, from say 23 through 29, I think that he represented a lot of youthful innocence and movie star good looks. I mean, he was almost a pinup boy for the prosperity of the time. But in 1929, after the stock market crashed, I think he took on a different role, and that is that he actually became the hero of the nation, and that he represented as an amateur somebody who was climbing to the top of the world at a time when the United States and much of the West was sinking to the bottom of it in what was beginning to be the Great Depression. And he represented in his amateur standing, in his education, in his very bearing in himself, he represented, I think, and of course I'm biased, but I think he represented everything that was really great about the American ideal at a time when we really, really needed a hero. And that's why when he came back to Britain in 1930 after winning the amateur at St. Andrews and winning the Open at Hoylake, that's why I think the city of New York recognized that and gave him that unprecedented, to this day, second ticker tape parade. Because bear in mind, John Glenn got a second ticker tape parade, but if it was in conjunction with some of the other astronauts that went with him in the space shuttle.
Yes. Yeah, there was a significant difference in that. I just think... You know, I have to agree with you, Dr. Bob. I think it was just the right time in the country needed a hero. Kind of similar to today, we could use more heroes like that. And I was fascinated by a story as a kid, and my dad introduced me to golf, and I got a chance. And the first book I ever read was Bobby Jones's book, and I was fascinated by the game, and of course my heroes then went on to become Jack and Arnold, and in later life, you know, just to watch Tiger, and to really understand the power, and that what Tiger brought to golf was to me similar to what your grandfather brought to the game back in the day. So we roll on. He retires in 1930, and when does this, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand that he was an engineer, even though his profession ended up being lawyer. He was an engineer, and I think, could you kind of share a little bit about what his makeup was? I mean, he was just this incredible, intelligent man.
He was extraordinarily intelligent. You know, Golf Digest ran a piece a number of years back, and it was, name the top five golfers that you would not want to have to play against on Jeopardy. And Bub was number one on that list. They said, you just don't want to have to compete with Bobby Jones on Jeopardy. And he was intelligent. And what's really remarkable about his intelligence is that it was so incredibly well-rounded. And I'll explain to you what I mean by that. Most very intelligent people are intelligent in one basic area. In other words, they have a particular affinity for engineering. And so everything they do is related to engineering or something somewhat related to it. Bub had one of the most well-rounded minds of anybody that I have ever encountered. And so he did his bachelor of science degree in mechanical engineering at Georgia Tech, graduating in 1922. And after that, he still wasn't 100% sure what it was that he wanted to do. But he knew that what he didn't want to do was necessarily be an engineer. So what he did was, he then went to Harvard, and he did a second bachelor's degree in English literature. And he graduated from there in 24. Now, that is an extraordinary shift.
Yes, it is.
Not too many people have degrees that are so different. as that. And his time at Harvard was very interesting as well, because he became fully involved in the life of Harvard College. He became a member of one of the men's final clubs, which is equivalent, I guess, of a fraternity up at Harvard called the Owl Club. And he was a very proud member of the Owl. He then went on to, it's funny, he wanted to participate with the Harvard golf team, but when he went to the coach, he said, "Coach," he said, "I'm sorry, I want to be able to help with the golf team, but unfortunately I'm a college graduate, and so I can't play on the team. Maybe I could serve as the manager." And the coach said, "Well, Bob, I'd love to have you serve as the manager," he said, "but we already have a manager, but I'm sure he would step aside for you." And Bob said, "Oh, no, no, no. Well, I wouldn't want him to do that. Is there any other position available?" And the man said, "Well, there's the assistant manager's position, but I'm sure you wouldn't want to do that." He said, "Well," Bob said to him, he said, "Well, sure, I would be very interested. However I can help, what does the assistant manager do?" And the coach said, "Well, your job is to keep the player's shoes clean and also to clean their clubs between the rounds." And Bob said, "Well, that's great. I'll do that." He said there was also one other job. Bob used to always say in later years that he had two jobs as the assistant manager. The first job was to keep the clubs clean. The second job was to guard the whiskey. And he said, "I was always far more proficient at the first than I was at the second." So he didn't do too well in guarding the whiskey because he tended to drink it all. But while he was at Harvard, he used to go out routinely and play the six members of the Harvard golf team. He would play against the six members of the Harvard golf team. He would play against their best ball, and nobody ever beat him. Their best ball of the Harvard golf team, and they had some pretty good players, their best ball never was able to beat him.
That's amazing.
Which, by the way, goes into a couple of other things that were very interesting about him, and that was that nobody ever beat him twice in match play in his entire career.
Wow.
And in his last, I believe, 10 U.S. Opens, he won four, was second in four, lost two of those in a playoff, and never finished out of the top 10 one time, except for one time when he finished 11th. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So he goes to Harvard and gets his second bachelor's degree, because he didn't know at the time if one of the things he might want to do was teach high school English. He loved education, and he thought that might be a good thing. A friend of his, George Adair, Perry's father, talked to him about possibly selling real estate down in Florida. And he went down, I believe, to Pensacola to sell real estate for a while and absolutely hated sales. And finally, his father said to him, "Look, son, why don't you come back up here to Atlanta and come in and go to law school and come into the practice of law with me?" So Bub went to Atlanta, went to Emory, and while he was at Emory, he went through the first year of law school. And then, as was very common, he took the bar at the beginning of his second year of law school, because a lot of people did that back then because it gave you a chance to practice it. Well, he passed the bar. And at that point, there was no requirement in the state of Georgia at the time that said you have to have a law degree to practice. It just meant you had to have passed the bar. So at that point, he quit Emory Law School after a year and a half and went into the practice of law with his father at a law firm, Jones Evans Powers and Jones. And later, over time, it has since become the law firm of Alston and Byrd, which is one of the largest and most prestigious law firms in the United States.
Interesting.
And he loved the practice of law. He was not, he was a very, very strong lawyer. His opinions were well considered by United States senators and by several United States presidents. And he enjoyed an outstanding career in the law for the rest of his life.
What was his field in law?
He did a lot of corporate law, trusts and estates. Never really was much of a litigator. He did not like litigation. There was a story that was told at one point that there had been this wrongful death case down in Macon, which is a little bit south of Atlanta. And in that wrongful death case, that Bub had gone out and played golf with the two lawyers and the judge. And the judge came back the next day and ruled in favor of Bub's client. And the story goes that Bub was so ashamed of this that he immediately wrote a personal check to the person who had been injured by the railroad for the amount of money that they would have won had they won the case. That is, I think you would agree, Gaylord, that that is a really beautiful story, and it says quite a bit about Bub's sportsmanship, doesn't it?
I think it does, most definitely. That's amazing.
Yes, unfortunately, there's no truth to it at all.
Yeah. There you go.
I'll tell you what actually happened.
Okay.
In 1933, Bub signed a contract with Warner Brothers Films for $250,000 to make a series of golf shorts, the films that you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Bub decided he wanted to take that money and fund trusts for his three children. But before he could do that and set the trusts up, he endorsed the check and cashed it. And the Internal Revenue Service came to him and said, "Excuse me, Mr. Jones, you have created what we call a taxable event. You owe income tax on that money." And Bub said, "Ah, that's ridiculous." So he filed a lawsuit in federal tax court about that case to protest that decision. And the tax court at that time in the state of Georgia was down in Macon because it was more central to the state than Atlanta. And so Bub went down to Macon to try the case in federal tax court. And the day before his hearing, he went out to play golf with the judge and the federal prosecutor, and they went over to Idlehour Country Club just to play golf. They played their round of golf, had a great time. The next day, they came into tax court. The judge heard my grandfather's argument, heard the government's argument. They said, "Mr. Jones, you have incurred a taxable event. You need to write a check to the United States Treasury right now, and we'll be done." So Bub wrote the check, and when he got the ruling back from the judge, it was about an inch and a half thick. He had it bound like a doctoral dissertation in a black leather cover with gold edging on the border, and he had it sitting on his coffee table in his home in Atlanta. And I remember saying to my father once, I said, "Dad, what is this thing?" He said, "It is the only case your grandfather ever tried and lost." And he told me about that story. And I said, "Well, why on earth would Bub keep something like this on his coffee room table?" And Dad said, "Bub always believes it's a good reminder to never act thoughtlessly."
There you go.
Personally, I think that's a better story, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. These are the kind of stories that my audience really loves. You know, there's tons of information, and I've studied his life, and you know, I'd kind of like to shift gears a little bit. You know, we've got a few minutes left, and kind of let everybody know what you're up to. I mean, you're a sports psychologist. You went and have several different degrees, and you know, you have this great insight into. I know you get asked a lot about your dad, but let's share a little bit about what's going on with you. And I know you've got this book upcoming, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And hopefully, when it's published, you'll come back and do another show with us.
Oh, I'd be honored to do it. You're right, I am a psychologist. I do a lot of work with athletes. I practice at the Behavioral Institute of Atlanta. May I put in a shameless plug for my website?
Absolutely.
It's a long website, but it's Southern Crescent Psychology, southerncrescentpsychology.com. And I do work a lot with athletes, and I really enjoy it and find it very, very fulfilling. There's nothing more enjoyable than seeing people come to me and being able to help them, whether it's a young person who's trying to become a championship golfer or a businessman that's trying to play better, or even a lady who just wants to win the nine-hole group. It is so exciting to watch people come to see me because they want to do better, and then to see them develop into the person that they want to be as an athlete. And what's so funny is I get the real pleasure to see how many times that development as an athlete leads to positive developments in other areas of their life, because as we all know, golf and life kind of go hand in hand.
Yes, it is.
So that's a really exciting thing for me, and I feel so privileged to be able to go and help people achieve their goals and dreams, and I get to do that for a living. Not many people have that privilege, and I feel very blessed in that regard. I've been doing that for about, I guess I'm in my 17th year now as a psychologist. I stay a little bit, or have stayed a little bit under the radar in that regard. That's kind of been intentional, but I guess my radar cover's starting to get blown a little bit more these days, but that's good too. As far as the book, a number of years ago, about 3 years ago, I really started to think about it, and I thought, you know, I've always kept fairly quiet, except for occasional interviews about my grandfather's life. But some books started to be published, I won't name them, but it all of a sudden had me realize, even though some of them were quite good, I realized if I don't do something, then I am leaving my grandfather's legacy to be defined by people that never, ever knew him, that never knew kind of the way he thought, the way he acted, that never knew what it was like to actually look this man right square in the eye. And I realized that if I did not do that, that would just be a tragedy for our family, because then there's no testimony to who this man was written from our, or at least in my case, my perspective. So I started working with one co-writer, and that, for a number of reasons, did not work out. And I tried working on this just on my own, and then I realized, you know, writing a book like this is very different from writing a doctoral dissertation. And so I found another co-writer that I've been working with now for about a year, and we have gone through exhaustive amounts of work. As he put it, he said when he does a book with people, he gets about 12,000 words from them. He said in your case, he said, you know, we did just our interviews alone gave him close to 80,000 words, not counting all the book forewords, articles, speeches, interviews that I've done over the years. So our task now is taking that and really separating out wheat from chaff and trying to write something that tells the story of my grandfather through my eyes and how I have come to understand him, and a little bit about how his life has affected me, and to do that in a way that is compelling to the average reader and not as long as Winston Churchill's 5-volume history of the English-speaking people. So that's kind of our task now, and we are finally at the writing stage. And the ideal would be if we could get this out by spring of 2018, in other words, by spring of next year,
right,
or Father's Day of next year, that would be ideal.
Great. So a little bit about the book. I mean, maybe something that a lot of people don't know about that you're sharing in the book, or just something that, because I know that you toward his latter years that you spent a lot of time with him in his home at Whitehall, I believe, and I've read some excerpts of some of the things that you've spoken about those times about Hoyt and all the. And just,
yeah,
you know, just some maybe a little bit about that. I mean, you know, the one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on the show, Dr. Bob, was because you had a relationship with him that, and the fact that you're going to leave this book as a legacy, I think it's just an amazing adventure. First of all, for you to do this is amazing, but I understand where it's coming from. And, you know, all we've ever read is from the eyes of other people, and but to get some insight into someone, as you say, who looked him straight in the eye, I'm fascinated. I can't wait till it comes out, because I'm kind of a golf historian, and I get your passion about helping people, because that's what I am as a golf coach, and I've done for 30 years. And
sure,
I got in the industry to play the game and compete, and then I ended up, my passion just switched over to teaching and coaching and working with kids, and it's, you know, it's so rewarding to see it, you know, the smile break out and to see him hit that shot for the first time that they didn't think they were capable of doing. And so, So I relate to your story in a lot of ways, and I'm fascinated. So if you could share something that a lot of people don't know about on the show, I'd really enjoy that, and I'd enjoy listening to it.
Sure, I'd be glad to share a few things. You know, there are a couple of things about Bub that I think were really quite remarkable. One thing was that he was an extremely emotionally demonstrative man. And by that, I mean this. Bear in mind, he was pretty much an invalid, and by the time I came along, certainly was on two canes, and that was as good as it was going to get. But, you know, a lot of people don't think of him this way, but whenever we would come to see Bub, Bub was a very emotionally expressive man, which would surprise a lot of people. For example, it was nothing for all of us when we got there as grandkids to give Bub a kiss. And I mean, we would kiss him on the mouth. And so the funny part was, that was the way he was with my father, too. I mean, he was just, when it came to his family, there was just no barriers between him and the members of his family. Now, having said that, he also was a very, he was a man that lived very much by the code of the game of golf, fairness and equity being, of course, big for him. And one of the stories that has never gotten much play was, well, let me take this from a slightly different perspective. If you read in the golfing press over the last 10 years, you will run across people who have made comments about how my grandfather, being from Atlanta, from the time he was here in Atlanta, my grandfather was obviously a racist. I'm sure you've seen the articles, the books, the interviews that have said those same things, right? You've seen those.
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm. ESPN.
Yeah, let me tell you about that.
Yeah, Charles Barkley.
Let me tell you about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and who I love as a basketball player and as an entertainer, but that's not obviously not a particularly well-researched line of thought.
Right.
Because I'll tell you a couple of stories. In 1930, when Bub had his ticker tape parade in New York, a bunch of folks came up from Atlanta, and Bub paid for the ticket of a man named T.J. Ray. And T.J. Ray was Bub's caddy at Eastlake. And Bub was no more going to celebrate his victories in Great Britain with T.J. Ray in Atlanta than he would anyone else in the family being left behind. So he paid for T.J. to come up and be with the family, and actually had T.J. standing on the platform with him when Jimmy Walker gave him the key to the city of New York. And when people started making noise about, well, who is this black man standing on the podium with Bobby Jones, Bub said, "Now I want to introduce the people up here," and he introduced everybody, and then he said, "This is my caddy from Atlanta, T.J. Ray." And all of a sudden, these people in New York started booing, and Bub told him, he said, "Now don't, you can't do that, T.J.'s family. You can't do that." Now that in and of itself doesn't say much, but then let's flash forward to 35 years later. Or 30 years later, a man named Charles Harrison, who's an outstanding amateur golfer, was getting ready to play in a U.S. Open qualifier at Eastlake, the Atlanta Athletic Club's Eastlake course, which was Bub's home club. And Charlie was paired with George Johnson, who was a very, very fine African-American golfer. And when George Johnson showed up at Eastlake, the caddy master of the athletic club said, assumed he was a caddy and pointed him toward the caddy barn. And Johnson said, "Oh, no, no, I'm here to play golf." Well, Charlie played 18 holes with Johnson, and then in the, as was the custom, he turned to George at the 18th hole. He said, "Well, George, before the afternoon round, they've got a buffet set up in the clubhouse for the players." And so Johnson said, "Well, all right, I'll go in and have lunch with you," which, you know, was still back in the days of a segregated South.
Right.
And, a lot of people at the athletic club at the time were very, very upset with this, and there was significant discussion as to whether or not this would... I think this is just not right, he said, and I think Bob Jones would agree with me. And the board said, well, we don't know about that. So Charlie went to Bub and told him what went on, and Bub sent a letter to the board and said, you know, if you are going to open your golf course up to have golfers come in to play, then they need to be treated in the same fair and equitable way that any golfer would be treated, regardless of their race, their religion, anything. The fact is that they are all golfers and all deserve equal treatment. A couple of years later, we had this green phone that basically was a line between my father in Massachusetts and my grandfather in Atlanta. And Dad was president of the Country Club of Pittsfield at the time. And there became a lot of conversation about what would happen if General Electric, our largest employer in Massachusetts, in Pittsfield, were to send an African-American to a position that was often offered a club membership. And Dad called up Bub and asked him that. He said, Dad, he said, if a man came to town who's ordinarily offered a position, a membership at the Country Club of Pittsfield, but he happens to be an African-American, what should we do? And Bub didn't even bat an eye. He said, you offer him the membership. You offer him the membership because that's the right thing to do. And Dad agreed with him. And I remember they didn't make an official board resolution about it, but Dad made an informal call to the board, and to this day, I don't believe the Country Club of Pittsfield has ever turned down a person based on race or religion or any other factors since that time. And I don't know what they did before. But the point I'm getting at is that for Bub, really embodied the Martin Luther King ideal of that a person should be judged not by the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. Bub lived that out every single day. And it really kind of boils my blood a little bit when I hear people who, A, know nothing about him, B, did not know him, and C, have no interest in learning about him, when I hear them pontificate on something as critical to who he was as a person, on how he treated others. That frosts me pretty well.
Well,
so I wanted to get that out there so your listeners would know that.
Yes.
Because most people don't.
Yes. And I'm glad you shared that with us. I can't wait
to
hear get your version of his life, from a family member who knew him well, and not only that, but from a psychologist who understands the concepts of that surrounded his life. And it's going to be an amazing book, and I'm excited about it. So here we are at Masters Week, and before I let you go, I know you're heading up there Friday and Saturday and Sunday, and what do you enjoy most now about the tournament? And just share that with our friends. A little bit about the tournament.
It's very funny. I mean, probably if you want to watch a golf tournament, probably the worst place you can be to watch a golf tournament is the golf course.
I agree.
I mean, because, I hate to say it, but that's true. I think the thing that I like the most about going to Augusta nowadays is I'm getting to that age where I love it because it gives me a chance to see people that I have known pretty much all my life that I would never see otherwise if it weren't for that tournament. I love getting a chance to visit with them, to share old memories, to make new ones, to make new friends. And it gives me a real sense of connection, not just with my grandfather, but also with my late father and also my great-grandfather. And if you could indulge me, I'll tell you what the highlight of these trips are for me.
Yes, please do.
Every couple of years or so, I'll be on the golf course, and my badge has my name on it, and somebody will come up to me. Like one year, I'll never forget, there was this old man who came up to me, and he had one of those hats on that was made out of all of his old Masters tickets. And he had probably been going to the tournament for 45 years. And he came up to me, this was probably, 15, 16 years ago. He my badge. I was standing by the 10th hole with my wife, Bibi. And he said, excuse me. He said, Bob Jones the fourth. I said, yes. He said, are you related to Bobby Jones? And I said, yes, he was my grandfather, sir. He said, oh, it is so, so nice to meet you. He said, you know, when I was a young man, I've been coming here for a long time. And I looked at his hat and I said, yes, I can see that. And he said, I've been coming here for a long time. And I remember when I was a young man and I would be down around the 12th hole, how your father would be driving your grandfather along in a golf cart so that he could see the action. And he said, I will never forget on a couple of occasions, your grandfather stopping right near me, and he and your dad talked to me and asked me about how I was enjoying the tournament, what I thought of Augusta National. And he said, your grandfather and your father were so kind and so nice to me when they didn't even have to be. And he said, I've never forgotten it. I never will forget it. And I just wanted you to know what that has meant to me. And, you know, I can guarantee you, you could win, I don't know how many Masters. You could have how many trophies and crystal in your trophy cabinet. But that memory alone would be enough, if you really think about it, to summarize who Robert Tyre Jones Jr. was and who Robert Tyre Jones III was. It makes me so proud to be their descendant, to be their son and their grandson. And the only hope that I have in my entire life is that at some point that I will be able to make the same kind of contribution to my family's legacy that these great men have. And it's such a privilege. It's such a privilege to be in this family.
And, you know, Bob, that's heartwarming. I've got to tell you, I know this book is part of that venture for you. But just for you to be there now and representing those two great men and in the same frame of mind that they had, and to have been mentored by them and to have watched them and to be able to continue to be a part of the tournament and to just hear those stories. And I can assure you that you're continuing on with the legacy of your grandfather and Augusta. And I can't wait for the book to come out. And, you know, I just know this to be a fact that golf now, as I've gotten older, it's all about the relationships with the people, my students and my fellow golfers and my men's club. And it's just all about relationships. And at some point when you realize that, the game takes on a whole new meaning for you. And I am so blessed to have had you on the show this week, and I'm so excited. And
thanks, Gaylord.
And God bless you for carrying on the legacy, and also for writing this book and putting the truth and telling the stories. And I've, you know, prior to the show, I got a chance to kind of run around and kind of catch up on some of the things you've been doing in some of your interviews, and I learned so many new things about it. And I can't wait for the book, and I do want you back when it's published. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Bob, and all the best to you, and have fun at the tournament. I'm going to be watching it on TV because that's the best seat in the house.
Absolutely. Well, you have a great time with that, and I really am honored that you've had me on today, and I wish you and your audience a wonderful Masters week.
Thank you, Dr. Bob, and we'll talk soon. God bless.
Very good. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, folks, it's time to say goodbye to this episode of Fairways and Greens. Hope you enjoyed the show. And if you would like to subscribe to the show, just head over to golfcoachpodcast.com. That's www.golfcoachpodcast.com. And don't forget to reach out with your questions and your input on the show to info@golfcoachpodcast.com. So reach out with your questions and anything you'd like to add or any suggestion on future shows to info@golfcoachpodcast.com. And you can find me, the Vegas Golf Coach, and a link to my blogs, coaching centers, and programs at www.vegasgolfcoach.com. That's www.vegasgolfcoach.com. So goodbye for now, and here's to finding your share of fairways and greens in your journey through life and golf.
This podcast was a presentation of lightupmedia.fm.